Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conference so far. I think that, well, we're going to end up also with the exciting talks. So what I'm going to talk about is, I don't know whether you already see the connection between cosmic censorship and the subject of this conference. Essentially, the idea is that what we want to probe, maybe not just quantum black holes, but quantum gravity in the sky. So my question here, what I will try to address is, well, how does one get to study quantum gravity in the sky? And this is something that we've heard talks about this, how you can form these fastballs, firewalls, whatever. So I'm going to discuss a few generic aspects of this problem. And well, please interrupt me at any moment. We can take maybe time from the discussion. I don't have many new results to report on. It's mostly a set of observations which I think one should keep in mind when discussing this problem.
Theoretical observations.
Yes. Of course. So, well, cosmic censorship, I mean, it's a statement, usually it's phrased in terms of classical gravity, but to me, cosmic censorship is mostly a conjecture about the behavior of how we can study the physics at the highest energy scales. Okay? And, well, there are different ways of phrasing it, but the version of cosmic censorship conjecture that I want to discuss here is that say that we start from initial data, which are all low energy density. Then we let it this evolve under the effects of gravity. And then, well, can these gravitational effects take us from these low energy densities to regions where we can explore quantum gravity? Say we can get to Planckian curvatures. And can we do this within a quick classical time scale? And what do I mean by this quick classical time scale? Well, I mean, the question is that if we can do this, if cosmic censorship is violated in the way that I explained here, then it's possible to form what one would call a singularity or some Planckian size object, and then predictability using general relativity is going to be lost. And this is interesting because we will learn about new physics. Thing is that we know how to, in principle, theoretically, how to construct, starting from low energy data, we can get to Planckian energy densities if we allow ourselves, a very, very long time to wait for it. And this is what I will refer to as a long quantum time scale. The way to do this is simple. You first form a black hole. It can be large. And then, well, you just wait until it evaporates down to the Planck scale. Of course, I mean, you better take a seat because it's going to take a very, very long time. So these are the time scales that are involved here. The classical time scale is essentially if you have a system with some mass, what I refer to as the classical time scale is the light crossing time. This is what's governing most of the processes that take place here. For instance, the collapse time or the relaxation time of the black hole. Okay? But, if you let the black hole evaporate, then you have a different time scale. This is the evaporation time, which is essentially the mass times the entropy, because this is the time that it takes to emit a single quantum. This is the number of quanta that you have to emit. And then, of course, as I say, this is a much longer time. This is the Hawking evaporation time, which is the time that it takes you to get to a black hole of Planck size. It's also a page time, essentially, and this would be the page time is the time that, if you're going to form a firewall, the firewall should have formed by the page time, by the time you reach this scale. It may have formed earlier, but it certainly must form at around the page time, which is the time when effects of unitary evolution should be apparent. Okay. But then, these are extremely long times, so, I mean, we don't have any hope of observing things on these timescales in this universe. So if this quantum timescale is required to reach quantum gravity, then, well, that's something that's beyond our any reasonable expectation. Then in this conference, we've also heard about another more subtle timescale that appears, which involves, again, the Planck mass, so it's not purely classical. But this is a much more interesting time scale, because this is something that we can expect to probe. This is what's sometimes referred to as the scrambling time for a black hole. The scrambling time, this is the time that it takes a system with a large number of degrees of freedom, the time that this system takes so that degrees of freedom, all degrees of freedom are entangled with each other. So the system is fully scrambled. It's also, presumably, the time that a fastball takes to tunnel. Well, I mean, if you have a collapsing situation, then this is probably the time that it takes for this collapse to tunnel into a fastball, according to Samir's picture. So this is a time that's interesting for this conference. It's also the echo time, even if this is not associated to the formation of the object, but it's a scale that appears here as well. Now, this time scale is different from the previous one. This involves a log, so this is just, it's larger than the classical time scale, but not much larger. It could be 40, 100 times larger, but it's not several Hubble times larger. So this is a time scale that we can expect to probe. The problem is that this is, what kind of quantum gravity effects, if any, are we probing if we wait for this time scale? Well, we don't expect, or at least it doesn't seem reasonable to expect, to form Planckian curvatures within this logarithmic time scale. And also that these processes that involve this time scale, they somehow seem to require large non-localities, like the ones that you find in fastballs. Okay? So it's not very clear how much quantum gravity we can obtain of this, or what kind of quantum gravity effects we can explore in this way. Now, in this talk, I'm not going to say too much about this, getting to these timescales. I'm going to discuss some other examples of cosmic censorship violations, which are well established, in which we can form, we know, I mean, there are these are examples. They are highly theoretical, but still, I mean, they are the best established examples that we have, of cases where we start from low energy initial data, and then we form naked singularities, where the curvature gets arbitrarily high within a time scale, which is this classical time scale, the typical light crossing time of the system. Okay. So which are these examples that I'm going to discuss? Well, one of them is critical collapse, and the other one is the black string stability. So both of them are very theoretical examples. It's not things that we can expect to observe in the sky now, but at least, well, it's, there are examples that we can study to see whether there's any hope of finding a useful window for exploring quantum gravity in this universe. So critical collapse is this phenomenon that was analyzed by Matt Choptwick in the early 90s. So I say that you start with some scalar field cloud, which has some amplitude. Then as you vary the amplitude and you let this cloud collapse, well, several things can happen. If the amplitude is large, this collapses, and then you find a black hole. If the amplitude is smaller, you change the amplitude. You have a one-parameter family of initial data here. So you, for a smaller amplitude, then, well, this cloud collapses, but it doesn't form a black hole. It bounces back, and it, then it dilutes away to infinity. But then, since this is a one-parameter family and you have these two regimes here, well, you also can also expect to find a critical value where the size of this black hole is, gets smaller and smaller as you decrease the amplitude. And then, well, from this side, you find nothing. So essentially what Matt Choptwick found is that there's a critical value where what you form is the zero mass limit of this black hole, which is a zero mass naked singularity. Okay. So this is a naked singularity that you form here. Now, of course, this is a zero mass. That's something that you don't expect to find. Before you get to this zero mass singularity where the curvature becomes infinite, you reach the Planck scale. So physically, what you expect in this process is that, for a small range of values around this critical value, what you're going to find is not a zero mass singularity, but a Planckian curvature object, which is a naked singularity. Okay. So this is an example where you can expect, you take you form your initial cloud, you fine-tune your parameters so that you end up in this object, and then, that you can observe quantum gravity. Now, my question is this a useful way, something that we can use in order to study quantum gravity in a way that's hopeful enough. Well, this example of a violation of cosmic censorship is often disregarded as a good violation of cosmic censorship because you have to fine-tune your initial data infinitely, or at least you have to fine-tune it within, well, a Planck region around your initial data. This is something that, this is an objection that it's valid, but it's not something that I think it disqualifies this as a good way of exploring quantum gravity. Especially because fine-tuning the initial conditions, what it means is that, you need experimentalists to do it. Experimentalists, their job is to fine-tune initial data so as to get to things which don't happen spontaneously in nature. Okay, so it's something that requires purposeful action. But then, of course, if it's something for experimentalists, it's not something for observers. It's something that we don't expect to happen spontaneously in nature. Okay, so this is not a good. This violation of cosmic censorship is not a good way, at least because of this argument, for observing something in the sky. Of course, you can also estimate if this is finite, if it's not infinite fine-tuning, and if it's finite fine-tuning, whether this is something that could have happened, say, by fluctuations in the early universe. Some of them may be in this sweet spot where you find the naked singularity. So maybe there's still some chance that, in the early universe, something like this might have happened. Probably not, because it's too rare. But there's another reason. Not only because of this effect that this is something that won't happen frequently in the sky, there's another reason that this critical collapse is not a good way of studying quantum gravity, and it's essentially that the object that you form, you start with a lot of energy, say, a solar mass or whatever, then you make it collapse, and then what you end up is with 10 to the minus 5 grams of singularity, which is not much. Okay? So it's a... there's not that much Planckian energy physics that you're going to be able to study here. And moreover, there's very little loss of predictability because you can make a reasonable guess of what's the evolution across the singularity. So you form something that, if you're starting from larger amplitudes, you're going to form a black hole. The black hole is going to be smaller and smaller, but we know that these black holes, what they're going to do when you form these black holes, they are going to evaporate through Hawking evaporation, and then at the end of Hawking evaporation, we don't really know what's the end point of Hawking evaporation, but a reasonable conjecture is that, what you end up is emitting a few Planck energy quanta, and then, you end up with this quanta escaping away, and then you get a flat space time. So this is the evolution of this zero mass or Planckian mass object that you form. Probably the evolution is going to be something that's similar to the endpoint of Hawking evaporation, but you don't get all the trouble that comes from the previous evaporation, because here you're forming the object through classical evolution, not through quantum evolution. So I think that in this case, we get to form a singularity, but we don't get to learn so much about quantum gravity.
Okay.
Yes?
If you could do this with less fine-tuning, you could form a black hole with a mass of, say, a mountain.
Yes.
And then it wouldn't take so long to evaporate and we could watch it.
Yes, if it's a mountain, yes. It's something that...
might want to stay a little ways away from it.
Yeah, that's something that...
Oh,
really? Well, no, but if it's the mass of a mountain, then the lifetime is the lifetime of a universe, right? It's a Hubble time.
Well, actually, yeah, let me see. We should check. Let's have a little bit less mass even.
Yes, yes. Then you can, then in that case,
less of a boulder.
Yeah, okay, fine. So that's what, we should see what our experimentalists, what kind of masses they can handle. And then,
can I just ask?
Yes.
So classically, these are sets of measure zero, so you have no chance of doing them. Quantum mechanically, have you thought about this in enough detail to be sure whether you can do this or not?
What you can do?
So classically, you'd have to find it's a set of measure zero.
Yes.
So it's you're never going to do it.
Yes.
So quantum mechanically, is it clear whether or not you can do this?
Whether I
don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that so the one should first analyze how much fine tuning you need in the initial data so that you end up in the.
That was the question.
And this is something that I don't really know whether you mean whether quantum uncertainty would prevent you from I don't know.
It's not clear.
Yeah, that it's a good question, but I don't know the answer. So, I mean, this is, then we can rule out, presumably, this example of this of evaluation of cosmic censorship in order to, well, to study quantum gravity in the sky. The other example is, well, it's in principle even less realistic for studying quantum gravity in the sky, but at least it's an example of a cosmic evaluation of cosmic censorship that's well established, and it's also been and it's the proof that it that one gets a violation. It's by Luis, who's back there, and Franz Pretorius. So this is the evolution of a five-dimensional black string. We're not in the our conventional 4D universe. We need additional dimensions. The thing is that if you take a 5D black string, which is as the Schwarzschild solution times an additional line, the fifth-dimensional direction that we're adding, and then if you let this evolve in time, does something like this. This is a video that you can find in YouTube. Maybe many of you have seen it. So what you see is that well, this black string becomes unstable. It forms large blobs, but then you also form thin tubes, and the curvature in these thin tubes is becoming larger and larger. Okay. So these are naked singularities that you form, and you form them within a time that's, well, maybe 100 times the light crossing time of this object, but it's something that it's not many orders of magnitude larger. So what we see here is that we're forming naked, arbitrarily large curvatures within a classical timescale of the system. And they form the area around this this neck. And in this case, we don't need any fine-tuning.
Is this true?
I think so.
So can you form, do you know that you can form black
circles? Yeah, I can give you an example. So for instance, say that we take this in a compact space, I mean a compact circle. And then, so I send a wave of the dilaton. So I put the initial state in a configuration where the string is stable. Then I send a wave of the dilaton, which would change the size of this circle. I make the size of the circle grow larger until I get into the unstable region. And then the system
no, but
just...
The question is if you can form black strings in the first place.
Well, by collapse. I can form a if I have a fifth dimension, mm-hmm. I can form a black string, just out
but
of.
But usually there's other mechanisms that try to prevent this sort of.
I think that I can form them just like a conventional collapse of matter. If my initial circle is sufficiently small, then this is what's going to be. I mean, any if we have a fifth dimension which is microscopic, then well. Any object is going to be, any black hole is going to be a black string extending this fifth dimension, then what I have to do is locally change the size of this circle, which is something that I can do. Well, in principle, if I have control over this additional scalar field.
You're forming first the first and you're extending.
Yes,
the,
okay. Yes. So, I mean, and that's something that doesn't require any fine tuning. It only requires you to, well, to have good control over the scalar field.
And one extra dimension.
Yeah, and one extra dimension, yes. But, well, who knows?
Right? We can probe.
Yeah. So, besides this issue of requiring an additional dimension, is this a useful way of violating cosmic censorship and studying quantum gravity? And then how can we say how strong is the loss of predictability in this case? So here I'm going to give you a model for what happens, how this black string gets to the singularity and then breaks up. It's something that I'm just going to describe in words and pictures, but it's something that we can put some equations into. I work with George Roche and Junpei Miyamoto that we've been doing over the years. It hasn't been finished yet. But the idea is that here we're taking the cue from the theory of the breakup of fluid jets, which is something that's well developed. So you see that this is how you begin with a jet of glycerol. You let it evolve. There's videos for this. Well, what you find is something that's very similar to what Luis and Franz found. So then our proposal, which as I said, we can make more precise, that well, in the case of a fluid jet breakup, what you find, how does a fluid jet break? Well, when the surface tension becomes large, then well, fluid dynamics breaks up. What you have is molecular dynamics, and then you form a very thin neck which evaporates, and then well, this jet breaks into droplets. And then the subsequent evolution is quickly described by an attractor in hydrodynamics. So we're changing just a few words here. Blackstream breakup occurs when the surface gravity becomes large. Then quantum gravity or string theory enters, and then you have a thin neck which evaporates, and the evaporation is Hawking evaporation, because you have something that resembles a very small black hole, an almost Planckian size of a black hole, and then it evaporates. And then the subsequent evolution, this is something that we are trying to argue, is that it's again described by classical gravity, by an attractor solution. So our proposal is that essentially that the breakup, how this very thin neck breaks up, is again, like in the case of the critical collapse, is controlled by the same physics that controls the endpoint of a black hole Hawking evaporation. You have a Planckian size black hole, it's going to evaporate in a few Planckian quanta, and this is what you get. So again, well, what we find is the same problem. What we find, we start with a very large mass, a very large object, and we end up with just a few Planck quanta. We don't get too much to study much quantum gravity here. It's like if you want to study molecular dynamics, then, well, by studying breakup of fluid jets, that's not a very efficient way of doing it, because you begin with a large object and then you get a few molecules. Here we start with a large black object, and we only get a few Planck Planckian quanta. So quantum gravity here doesn't almost play any role. We can predict almost all the evolution by using classical general relativity, with solutions which are in fact attractors. The solutions that lead you to the formation of the singularity and the evolution after the singularity, both of them are classical general relativity attractors. So then, if this is what I'm saying correct, both in the case of blackstream breakup and the case of a critical collapse, cosmic censorship is violated in a very mild way, something that doesn't allow us to study quantum gravity in any efficient way. So we want to define an index, a strength index for violations of cosmic censorship. If you start with some given mass m and then you form a singularity that concentrates only a fraction of this mass, then, well, we can define an index, which is a power law here, that would say that when this index is one, you have a very strong violation of cosmic censorship, which means that an order one fraction of the mass goes into the singularity, whereas s equals zero is the case that we have been studying, that you have a very mild violation, that only a Planckian amount of mass of the initial energy goes into the singularity. Okay. So, well, let me, yeah, should I be rushing up? So if we form a naked singularity with, naked singularities with s equals zero, forming them, it's something that's not very useful. It's something that doesn't bring you new physics. Predictability is almost unbroken. So we would like to get formation of naked singularities, violations of cosmic censorship, which are stronger with s larger than zero. Okay? One of the potential problems with this is that they could violate entropy bounds, because if you can concentrate all of the information of your initial matter into an object that's very small, well, this looks like it could be could violate the area bounds on how much entropy you can, how much information you can concentrate in a given region of space-time. Whereas violations with s equals zero are harmless if you want to. Are harmless for the entropy bounds, but they are also useless for studying quantum gravity. So maybe violations with S positive are something that the reason that we cannot get them easily is because they could be forbidden by thermodynamics. This is just a proposal, some conjecture, hasn't been proven. But maybe the reason that it's so difficult to violate cosmic censorship is because you're trying also to violate something that's thermodynamics. And thermodynamics is something that is remarkably robust. So there's this question that I would like to raise. Is cosmic censorship at the end of the day a consequence of thermodynamics? Well, we don't know, but this is a possibility. And to conclude this talk, what we seem to be finding is that there's a very little chance that we have of observing quantum gravity effects within classical timescales. There is this timescale, which is quantum, You need a Planck scale, you need some scale here. So there's some hope, if there's any hope of observing quantum gravity in the sky, I think it's through these timescales. But then, well, what kind of objects form within these timescales? Well, we've seen fastballs. And one of the big issues in this conference is whether fastballs actually reveal something about quantum gravity. And this seems to be, well, it's a question that hasn't been settled, but it seems to be hard to extract quantum gravity effects from these objects. So, I mean, I don't know, it seems like life is hard, right? There seems to be some, nature seems to be conspiring against, well, giving us easy ways or quick ways. So, yeah, who knows? But, well, maybe there's some conspiracy against, well, getting this effect easily, but, well, maybe no, and this is what we're trying to learn. So thank you.
What about jumping into a large black hole?
Yes.
Right? Then you'd have a chance to study quantum gravity, and there wouldn't appear to be...
Okay, you're welcome to try. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so that would be, I mean, there are these, the weak cosmic sensitivity conjecture and the strong cosmic sensitivity conjecture, whether, because you, well, maybe you want to have the singularity in your past. That's the strong cosmic censorship conjecture, which says that you're not allowed to do that even if you jump into a black hole. But what I've discussed is less radical than...
And what about the Big Bang? Aren't we discussing?
Yeah, the Big Bang, yeah. But then we don't know whether the Big Bang actually gets us to Planckian curvature, right? If there's a phase of inflation, that's another part of the conspiracy. Maybe inflation is part of this conspiracy that pushes Planck scale physics to the infinite past or to the remote past.
Other comments, Samir?
So I'm just interested in this last comment that there might be a conspiracy which stops you from measuring things easily. I think I would like to think of something exactly like that. I saw sometimes called the correspondence principle, that if you go to scales bigger than Planck mass, you make a big black hole. Even though the physics is of quantum gravity or fuzzball is very different from the classical one, somehow just like in quantum mechanics, where the actual is much more than h bar, then classical mechanics are good approximation, even though theories are completely different.
Yeah.
Somehow, whenever you're doing things at energies higher than Planck mass, somehow the classical gravity should turn out to be a good approximation, so that you can't actually see the quantum effects.
Yeah.
So for example, in fuzzballs, the fact that they are highly absorptive because large number of degrees of freedom, it behaves like the same boundary condition as you have at a horizon, incoming boundary condition where everything smoothly falls in.
Yeah.
And here you come to a surface, everything gets absorbed.
Yeah.
So in some sense, that thought might be like a correspondence principle, just like quantum and classical mechanics. And so that could be like a conspiracy.
Yeah. I mean, we can also observe quantum gravity. There's non-relativistic quantum gravity. I think this is something that we have a chance of observing. But this, I mean, this is something that would involve G and H bar, but not C, the speed of light. In this case, there's no length scale involved, and this is something that maybe can, well, people are trying to study it, but it would be different physics. So maybe there's some quantum gravity, but relativistic quantum gravity is what's really hard.
Last question, Don.
Yeah. Well, I might say I actually did an experiment about testing quantum gravity in the non-relativistic. But anyway, but my big question was, there are these instabilities if you have perturbations in anti-de-Sitter space, because they tend to form little naked singularity. Yes. I suppose that, is that like the black string, that you just only form little tiny
yeah.
Planck mass things,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. So there are other, as you say, there are other violations of cosmic sensorship that have been studied and proposed in recent times. Some of them involve, things that break up in anti-de-Sitter space into small black holes, so they would be in the same class. There's another class of violations, like what Thomas told us yesterday about, and it's there are related violations of cosmic sensorship, like, for instance, George Santos and Gary Horowitz have recently studied one of them. Those ones, I think that they can be disposed of with the same arguments that I've given here. The ones that Thomas and George and Gary have been studying, in that case, it hasn't been studied what's the time scale for the evolution to give you the singularity. Because it's something that involves essentially moving in solution space and then not the actual time evolution. So they are less well established, and maybe, they are conjecturing also that the weak gravity conjecture may play a role in avoiding those violations. So, I mean, I chose these two ones because I think that they are kind of paradigmatic of what we know about it. But there are other possibilities. And it's worth exploring other possibilities.
I think probably it's a good time to move on. Thank you.